I went out with a girl at college who was like dead into Speedway, so I went to that a few times. It's a funny sporting crowd, that. Proper minority sports vibes, and everyone, you sort of feel like everyone who goes there all the time knows you're just there on a lark.
Yeah.
And you sort of, you feel very judged for not knowing the ins and outs, and I don't know. I went a few times just because, like, you know, why not? Thing to do with your missus, but safe to say, since that relationship ended, I have not watched any sport.
My driving instructor was into Speedway. Bellevue Aces, they were called, weren't they?
They were, yeah, the Aces.
Yeah. Oh, the Aces. Is that what the fans refer to them as?
This is Blue Moon. It's the original fan-made Manchester City podcast. Coming up, we've got news and views from City's Week. It's your club, and this is your show.
The season starts here. It would have started last week if Manchester City had won the Community Shield, but they didn't, so it didn't. Instead, we're gearing up for the opener against Burnley on Friday night. 1 week into the campaign, and the fixture list is already playing about with when you get to hear the Blue Moon podcast, 24 hours earlier because of a pesky Friday night game. To that end, we're going to be taking a look at the time City have played on a Friday night later in today's show. Sam Roscoe's been through the archives of the Premier League era, and there's a surprising number of talking points from Fridays in years gone by. We'll also take a look into the matches with Burnley and Sevilla. Yes, the Super Cup surprise does as well, but that's happening this week too. Will that be more important than the Community Shield? Well, you can find the answer to that on Wednesday evening at about 10 o'clock. I suppose we'd better begin by discussing the game at Wembley at the weekend. I'm David Mooney, and to join me in doing just that, we've got City fan Kieran Murray.
Hello there.
And from Sporting News, Dom Farrell.
Hello, lads.
So, season kicks off next week, Dom.
I don't know. When's the parade for the Community Shield?
I know.
They're all doing the Tony Adams thing outside Islington Town Hall. Sorry.
I didn't want to be like that, but I know.
A bit weird, wasn't it?
Yeah. Kieran, have you celebrated a Community Shield win? We haven't won one in years, but have you celebrated one like that in the past? Mancini's one, maybe?
I remember that Tevez goal in the maroon kit. I was pretty happy with that. And then Chelsea went down to 10 men. City sort of kind of scraped a win in the end, I think. And other than that, I don't think I remember any events from any other Community Shield. Kyle Walker's overhead clearance off the line.
Oh, that was good. Yeah. That kit was good as well.
Gorgeous kit, yeah. Yeah, that's right. I have quite vivid memories of that. And Casey's daughter's christening, we watched that game. I kind of associate that with a memory, but no, it is exactly. It's bizarre. You don't like to police other people's celebrations, but it is a glorified friendly that was invitational for Arsenal as a result of City winning both the Premier League and the FA Cup.
And they finished level.
yeah, and it was a 1-1 draw. So
via a massive deflection. Like, lads, that's some shame here, you know.
I don't understand why they're celebrating so hard anyway, because Liverpool won it last season. And then ended up finishing fifth last year. And the year before that, Leicester won it, who are now relegated. So there's not great future ahead for the Community Shield winners.
It's an improvement. They might finish third.
Well, yeah.
Well, before we get into all the analysis, we're pleased to announce that this season of the Blue Moon podcast is sponsored by Green King Sports, where football is more than a game. Green King Sport venues are showing every single televised City fixture over the 23-24 season. And with more than 900 sports pubs across the UK, it doesn't matter whether you're based in Manchester or Middlesbrough, you can catch every single minute of the action. Keep an eye out during the season for events, offers, content and competitions that put you closer to the action. And if you can't get yourself down to Turf Moor for the season opener against Burnley, we'll preview that later on in the show as well, then why not catch it on TNT Sports in the next best place, a Green King pub. Let's get to the Community Shield then. Dom, I was laughing and joking about the record after winning the Community Shield, and we're laughing and joking about the celebrations. I'm cautious of trying to take too much from it, but is there an element to what Arsenal are talking about, or certainly Arsenal fans are talking about, and a little bit of Aaron Ramsdale about being able to kind of get one over on City in that game?
I think that's more a thing for themselves. I mean, I think you're not getting one over on the team that have just won the three most important trophies. I think it's an important thing for Arsenal because that no one expected them to win the league last year, but the manner in which they didn't was pretty sapping. You know, I mean, not obviously when they lost to Forest and City were crowned, but that day when City won at Goodison, and then they got annihilated at home by Brighton, it was like, and also getting turned over massively at the Etihad Stadium, it was like there's probably a fair few mental scars there. So I think after having already got the piss taken out of the way, I think you can explain those celebrations by it was a little bit of, you know, bit of an exorcism for him for what had been a pretty horrible couple of months. I get that. I'm also not entirely sure that bodes particularly well for a very good title bit run next time around, because so much of what Arsenal did last season was fueled by emotion, and you sort of ride that wave. And last season they reminded me, it was like a combination of when City won it for the first time with Mancini in 2011-12, and then when Rodgers' Liverpool nearly won it in 13-14, that they were like Liverpool because they just kept winning and winning, and they sort of went to see how far they could keep that rolling. And with the Mancini team, there was so much emotion, which all sort of blew up the year after because everyone ultimately hated him. But I don't know. They needed to go with that last year. But I then think this summer they've had a really impressive summer, not just in who they've bought. I mean, I still don't really understand the Kai Havertz thing, much less than anyone else who keeps playing him at centre forward. But, you know, Rice is a great buy. Timber looks good. They got all the business done early, which is always, and I think back to City's best summer since the takeover, it's when they get things done early, which is interesting for this year. But I think in doing that, that's when I think they've got to take a next step on and sort of be a bit more of a refined, calm team. And I know last minute equalisers, 111th minute equalisers are good fun and all that, but it did look to me like, you know, not that I'm telling anyone to grow up here or anything, but I sort of am. And if they're going to take a next step and be better than they were last year, and they've got to move on from that emotion that was fueling them. But that seems to be all that was there at the end, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Kieran, are you expecting them to be in the title mix this season? Because it's a difficult one because, like, we as fans, we sit here every season and say that City are going to be in the mix because that's how life is these days under Guardiola. The only year that they weren't, Liverpool ran away with it. And if Liverpool weren't running away with it to the extent that they were, City were probably going to be in the title mix. So are you expecting Arsenal to be City's nearest challengers again?
Nearest challengers is a really difficult one to predict for this upcoming season. I think they were a surprise package in how they sort of ran away with the league in the early parts of last season. In fact, for the like sort of first two thirds of the season. But Dom's absolutely right. There were mental scars there. They bottled it, plain and simple. And they're riding that wave of emotion to the point where they're putting too much pressure on themselves, I think. They've all of a sudden kind of decided that they want to be in the title conversation again and that Arteta's the man to kind of do that. And they've sort of manifested themselves into, you know, buying the biggest players that they can. They bought Jesus and Zinchenko from us last year, proven title winners. They've gone out and kind of usurped City to Declan Rice's signing. Apart from Havertz, it looks as if they've had a pretty good window. I agree with Dom. I don't see what the point in him is really. But I think emotionally and psychologically, they need to get themselves in check a little bit. Did you see the pictures floating about last week where they were showing the new signing, Hank Timber, a kind of like blacked out version of the Premier League trophy? And they're like, the one way we can put colour in this is to win it. They just seem to be, it's an unbelievable need to the point where I think it's going to do them damage in the end. They're forgetting about the other teams who've been nipping at their heels. Liverpool have strengthened as well. United have strengthened. Chelsea have a decent manager again. It looks like Spurs do too. And whilst I'm not saying all those teams will be involved in the title race itself, they'll all be seeking to take points off each other. And I think Arsenal need to be a bit careful that they could say a done deal. They're going to kind of walk into a toe-to-toe battle with City again, because every single season, every single circumstance that changes every season is different.
Yeah. Dom, for City, we'll come to transfers a little bit more later on, but are there any concerns going into this season that City are not quite the force that they were last year?
I mean, after you've sort of scaled the mountain, as they did, I guess you're always going to fear a bit of a drop-off. No team has ever won four in a row. The reason for that is hard to motivate and go again. And then also you look at obviously Haaland is a machine who probably scores lots more goals again, but the goals and goal involvements that you lose from Gundogan and Mahrez haven't really been replaced. I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about how wonderful Kovacic has looked in pre-season, but he's not really a like-for-like for Gundogan. I think it's fair to say the squad does look a bit weaker, but to pick up on what Kieran said, like, I've kind of been thinking that, yeah, probably City don't do it again. But then if you look at all the would-be sort of pretenders to the throne, I'm not sure there's enough of a leap from any of them to finish above City. So it's a difficult one, because there's also the other thing. I mean, again, we'll talk transfers in a bit, but the squad does look small and maybe a little bit too small this year in terms of senior players, but Guardiola does like small squads. I mean, saying Pep's got a small squad's a bit like saying he's bald. It's a thing.
Just the truth, yeah.
He looks very, very bald at the minute, but nevertheless, it's been a funny summer, hasn't it, in some ways?
Yeah. Let's talk about what was good then from the Community Shield, because I'm careful not to kind of go too much of a downer on this in what was a glorified friendly. Dom, you mentioned Kovacic already. He was good, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's one of those sort of those Croatian midfielders that's just that generation that always been great to watch. Obviously, he's a bit younger than Modric and Rakitic and guys like Brozovic. It's just fellas who are properly like see the whole picture on the other, you know, sort of 360 degree footballers, lovely touch, lovely technique. It's kind of mad Guardiola's never had one of these Croatian guys in his team before, because that it just looks like such a perfect sort of guy that fits that Guardiola style. And
wait, is he the first Croatian that Guardiola's managed?
First Croatian midfielder, I think.
Okay. That's a hell of a question for me to ask you when you've got no way to research it in this time.
Off the top of my head, I think he had Mandzukic at Bayern Munich.
Good shout.
Who didn't like him at all. But, you know, different strokes for different folks, innit? That's it. He's had a 6'4", stick it in the mix of Croatian centre forward, but not a twinkle toed Croatian midfielder, which I think is weird. Yeah, I thought he looked really good. I think he's looked great in all of pre-season, particularly sometimes when he played deep in the midfield. More great news for Calvin Phillips' City career, I think. it's interesting because for all that there's this perception, you know, Guardiola likes a team full of midfielders and he signs lots of midfielders, but he hasn't really signed someone to play in like the sort of those number eight positions, as we call them now, since Bernardo Silva in 2017. You're saying Gundogan was his first guy through the door. De Bruyne and David Silva did that job a lot. Bernardo didn't really play in midfield at all in his first year, and then only played there if De Bruyne wasn't there. It takes an awful long time, it seems, for him to trust guys to get for the let me talk drinking game, get the pauser, get all that rhythm of the play and all that stuff. He's quite precious about letting people in there. You know, a big conversation has been, when's Phil Foden going to move centrally properly if he ever does? But here's a guy who he just brought in and dropped in and seems to like get all of it. I mean, I mentioned David Silva. There's stories about when Pep started at City that he was explaining the concepts and all that to all the players. And the conversation with Silva took about 5 minutes. Now, I'm not comparing Kovacic to David Silva, but I would imagine it wasn't a particularly long chat with him.
Yeah. Yeah, the other player that I thought stood out, Kieran, was Stefan Ortega. I thought he was bloody good. And I'm wondering if there's pressure on Edison like there's never been pressure on Edison before.
Yeah, he was brilliant. And to be honest with you, every time I've seen him play for City, he has been so impressive. To think about where we got him from, it was a free transfer from a relegated Bundesliga team, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Arminia Bielefeld, I believe.
What?
I have no idea. That was just noise. I have no idea what you just said.
Yeah. I was thinking I'm going to give myself away embarrassingly here by not knowing the name of the team, but it's a pointless answer from Dom there, I think. But what a bargain to pick up him and Akanji last year, sort of out of nowhere, really, relatively kind of like on the down low, and for them to prove their worth so well anytime they're called upon. It's just brilliant. The funny thing is about Ortega is that as a footballer, he reminds me of Ederson. When they pass out from the back, I mean, obviously he doesn't have that kind of like, heart in your mouth sort of way that Ederson has sometimes. Where
what you mean is a normal human being instead of the most relaxed freak on the planet. Yeah,
yeah, that might be it, yeah. But then at the same time, Ederson has these moments where he's tempted to lose his head. So he's this mad paradox in that he's so relaxed when kicking the ball about at the back. And then every so often there's just a head loss in terms of like being a goalkeeper and using his hands and communicating with his back four.
All of that said, I'm wondering, like, you think back to the back end of last season and the performance Ederson puts in the Champions League final is a Champions League final winning performance. And
well, that's it. So your question about...
Yeah, I'm wondering if that is down to Ortega being there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's it. I seem to recall, if you remember the old Pellegrini trick when Joe Hart was going through a dip and he brought in Pantelimon, like, all of a sudden it gave Joe Hart the sort of kick up the arse that he needed at the time. And this is the first proper challenge to Ederson's place and status that there's been since he arrived, I think. Who have we had? Caballero? Was he there?
Yeah, it's a funny way to pronounce it, though. I've never heard it said like that before.
Yeah. I was sort of thinking and pronouncing at the same time. Bravo.
Thank you.
Yeah,
that's a terrible joke.
But Muric, who Zach Steffen, there was just they were never really going to challenge them. So Ortega has got so much of what Ederson has in his game, but also is an amazing shot stopper and a very, very calm head. But then you look at what, as you've just said, David, what that has encouraged and brought out of Ederson can only be a positive thing, because it was probably his best all-time performance in the Champions League final, and what a time and what a stage to leave your masterpiece performance to.
Yeah. Dom, the other player that stood out was City's goal scorer, Cole Palmer. What chance do you think he has this season of being, I'm not going to say the Mahrez replacement, but being an option to replace Mahrez?
Well, if you look at the game in isolation, he was the Mahrez replacement. I found that encouraging. Obviously, the goal itself is encouraging, but there's two types of sort of young players on the bench that Guardiola tends to have, and it's like, do you become Rico Lewis, who is genuinely involved, or are you a 3-0 up, come on for a kickabout guy, which Palmer generally was last season, Sergio Gomez was, and those lads. But coming on
more,
at nil-nil...
More great news for Calvin Phillips' City career is that he's not one of them either.
Yeah, but he's too old to be a young lad, isn't he? Yeah, sorry, Calvin. Yeah, so he came on at 0-0. Like, if Mahrez was still there, you imagine Mahrez would have come on when Palmer came on. So that felt like a good little show of faith. He was obviously really bright. Coming on around the time Foden and De Bruyne did was when City had their best creative period of the game with their best creative midfielders on. And he scored a brilliant goal. So that's all great. But I think if you look at the noises around it, like, this is a summer when Guardiola's like basically been going, you know, laying on two-hour sushi dinners to convince Kyle Walker to stay. And, it's where there's been a little bit of a crack in that if you bring us an offer, you can leave. They've worked really, really hard to keep a couple of guys that didn't want to go. Palmer, it's like, I don't know what's going to happen. And in Guardiola speak, I don't know what's going to happen sometimes means I don't really care what's going to happen. And, you know, he's not that invested in it. Because on the preseason tour, you know, McAtee and Bob were playing he'll probably got more minutes than Palmer. So, and Brighton have been linked to him. Obviously, he's been suggested with these Lucas Paquetá rumours. He's been suggested as a make weight at West Ham. So I think it might be a case of transfer soon come for Cole.
Yeah, it's make weight's such a horrible term, isn't it? It's like you're literally just ballast. That's what you are.
It's absolute transfer guff as well, and I'm sorry I slipped into it. Sky did like one of the really old-fashioned ones about Lucas Paquetá saying he'd had his head turned by City.
Yes.
Like he's an owl or something. It's like, what's all that about?
Yeah. The other thing with Palmer is Adam Carter, who was a quick peek behind the curtain, was supposed to be on this this show, but decided to go to the cricket instead.
Not even proper cricket.
Yeah, not even proper cricket. He would kill me now if I don't mention that Cole Palmer is the City player that scored in the most competitions without having scored in the league for City, in the Premier League or Football League.
Given his quote, it's so good.
He's now hit five competitions that he scored in, and not one of them is the league. So
that's
so,
amazing.
Five?
Yeah.
What are those then?
Well, I mean, why would you ask me when you could go on to statcity.co.uk and find out? And it's definitely not, because I don't know the answer. A very little quick post-edit correction coming up now, because I, of course, got this stat wrong. Cole Palmer has not scored in five competitions without having scored in the domestic league. That would be impossible. He scored in four competitions, but he has scored five goals, which is the most by any City player without having scored in the domestic league. You can see where I got it wrong. It will, of course, become five competitions when he scores in the Super Cup on Wednesday night.
By the way, it didn't go viral like his last one, but another brilliant Palmer interview after the game, by the way. Did you see that?
I'd not seen it, what did you say?
Right, so it was the fella, and talking of like, you just pulled me up on using like football guff. So the guy who was interviewing for ITV, so I presume would have been Gabriel Clark, and he spoke to him about the game, and you know, disappointed, scored a goal, wanted to win, blah, blah, blah. Second question was like, because he'd had a shot before he scored his goal. Gabriel Clark goes, "You had a bit of a sighter, didn't you?" And he went, "What does that mean?" It's so good. But then you think, you're a 21-year-old kid from Manchester. It's like, him and his mates aren't talking about sighters like they're all John Motson, are they? So, yeah, but I think it's still on ITV's Twitter. It's, yeah.
Oh, God.
I'd like to see more of him for City or someone else, just so he does post-match interviews, because he's got no filter at all.
Yeah, give him man of the match every week, because then he has to do them.
You can listen to the show ad-free by joining our Patreon, patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Kieran, before we move on, I want to give you your credit, because you deserve to go into the dictionary for dubbing what happens at the end of games now giant stoppage time. is it sour grapes, or is there a legitimate grumble with eight added minutes at the end of a game? Given that City and Arsenal are probably the two teams in the country at the moment that are actually trying to keep the ball in play as much as they can.
It's certainly not sour grapes, because do you mean with reference to the result?
Yeah, because City were winning that until the 111th minute.
I don't think it could be sour grapes, because I literally don't care about the Community Shield. So when I check myself there and go, am I just annoyed because City lost? Then no, I'm not. I don't like change anyway.
All right.
as a person, but change in football when there are so many other issues that kind of aren't getting sorted first. Change that seems unnecessary, change that is trying to be a solution to a problem that does exist, but is going around it just a completely kind of bonkers way.
Yeah. Is there any reason why you need to add on 8 minutes? Could you not just start booking players for time wasting early?
That's it. Exactly. Yeah. The amount of times, the amount of frustrations there's been, particularly at the Etihad, where, and we sit behind the goal so we can see it very, very clearly. Like, the keepers take all day to get the balls back off the ball boys, or to pick the ball back up from behind the net.
Because that Newcastle game's at 8 p.m. kickoff. That's not going to finish till after midnight, is it?
Well, that's it, yeah. And people, like, one of the easy kind of retorts from Twitter nauses is, if you love your team enough, it doesn't matter, like, you'll stay till the end regardless. And, like, that's absolutely fair. I kind of get that. But, I mean, everybody's got homes to get to and trains to catch, and you were cutting it fine anyway from an 8 o'clock kickoff. Saturday night, 8 o'clock kickoff is mad. And then if they're going to add 8, 10, 12 minutes on at the end, when they could just be booking players for time wasting, and they could try and they could be trying to cut out feigning injuries and kind of methodical, you know, the keeper going down in half an hour with cramp or whatever it is that they're up to nowadays, you know. I get that the ball in play, the ball isn't in play as much as we would like to think or hope. Teams are taking the piss with it all, but it just feels like the play. I mean, tiniest violin in the world for the players, but like their season and their games are going to be extra long now too. The fans are going to be around. Think of the staff who have to stay, you know, much later to tidy up after everybody leaves. It's just, there seems to be a solution to a problem that hasn't really been figured out when there are so many other issues. Like people still haven't got their head around VAR, and there are still massive mistakes with the officiating that way. And then they've launched these new protocols, initiatives, directives, and like it's going to just make things even worse for them. Like, it's just too many people. It just feels like too many cooks are really spoiling the broth here. And instead of just keeping it simple, and actually consulting fans or players or managers, it just feels like these kind of suits or officials are kind of making decisions without actually thinking of contingency plans and thinking, but what if this happens and what if this happens and what if that means that. It's just like one decision seems to be slapped on the table and everybody goes for it, and then the consequences come along later when everybody kind of gets back to the game and goes, this isn't working. So yeah, no, definitely not sour grapes, to go back to your question. Just something that I don't really like the idea of. Maybe it will, you know, if time wasting stops becoming an issue, maybe we can get back to 3 or 4 minutes or whatever. But I just don't see this being good for anybody, really.
Yeah, I can't see, Dom, if that game had been 3-0 at the point of stoppage time came up, I can't see them adding 8 minutes in that instance. It's one of them where it only becomes a thing when the game's really tight, and that doesn't really seem... I mean, I guess that'll probably benefit City more often than not, but, you know, it just doesn't feel like that, like a solution, like the right solution.
Yeah, I mean, but it's the shiny new thing, so they would have added 8 minutes regardless, and if City were 3-0 up, it would have been a different kind of shit. It's the new thing. Like, there was that season... I think Guardiola's first one, actually, at City, when every shirt pull in the penalty area was a penalty, and then they decided, hang on, this is rubbish. And there are, like, so many of these new things that are introduced. Like, you heard Guardiola and De Bruyne, and then Raphael Varane, and he put a long statement out about it the day after the game, all saying that, like, we haven't been consulted about this. We just got told this is what's happening now. And it's like, why not consult with players about rules? Those are the people playing the game. Yeah. Those are the people who understand the game.
I saw the response to Varane, where somebody had said, I can't remember who it was, but somebody had quoted Varane's tweet and said, just get the ball in play quicker and they won't add all that time. And it's like, well, I'm only responsible for 50% of that. The other team is part of this as well.
Yeah, that's another thing. Yes, yeah, so if you're playing against a team who have time wasted loads and loads, and then they concede, they then get 15 minutes to have a go and equaliser. So that's rubbish as well. So it's riven with problems. It's another one of these things. Like, you know, maybe well-intentioned, you know, because people don't like time wasting. People don't like time wasting. But like you said, just book the players. No one asked for, you know, giant extra time. People don't like, you know, penalties not being given for on ball. No one wanted defenders jumping around like salmon, like they have with their arms behind their head. People don't like offside. People don't like a complicated offside rule. No one asked for goals like the one United scored in the derby last year. It's all of these things. It's
unintended consequences. Yeah,
they're solutions to problems that no one ever thought were problems. You know, armpit offsides would be the infamous armpit offsides would be another one. It's like it's all part of this. It's this idea of like responding to what the powers that be perceive that fans want, and you know, people want this and they want that, and it starts off with a truth of what people want, but then it ends up such a mess. It's the rulemaking equivalent of that of that car that Homer Simpson designs with a massive horn on the top. And it's just all a massive mess. But like all the composite parts are things that blokes like on cars, but it's a shambles when it's done.
I've just realised, have we become three old men grumbling about how football used to be better in our day?
Yeah, but I've just done it with a Simpsons reference, so I'm cool. That point, though, I was always someone who was like a pretty strong VAR advocate. People that go, oh, it's part of the game. It's like, I'd rather decisions weren't shit. It's not part of the game. But one of the reasons football is so universally popular, speaking as someone who is, you know, also a big cricket fan, football's dead easy to understand. And it flows, and because it flows, it has imperfections. You keep driving to make the game perfect. It never has been perfect. You end up with these absurd outcomes, and this like massive chunks of injury time is just the latest one. And yeah, it isn't sour grapes, because as Kieran says, it doesn't really matter. I actually thought it was quite funny when after, because it was injury time added on to the injury time, because. On that, by the way, when we talk about player welfare, Kyle Walker and Thomas Partey suffer head injuries then at a point when they shouldn't have even been on the pitch.
Yeah. Mm.
So it was added time to the added time. So it's stupid. And it's not sour grapes, because City will benefit from this probably more than most teams, because they keep the ball better than anyone else. And then if people do get the ball in play quicker, which is the aim, that's going to be absolute salad days for City and Guardiola. But it's just rubbish.
Alvarez booking was nonsense as well, if you remember, when he kicked the ball in the touch and was booked for kicking the ball away.
It's particular nonsense when they're doing like the multi-ball thing. So yeah, there was a ball boy there waiting for us. So it literally wasted the whole time. But yeah, so we're handing out bookings for that, but we're not going to hand out bookings for actual time wasting. And it's a directive that allows refs can just defer to the directive rather than making any decisions and kick the can down the road until we play for another 10 minutes. I just, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. What would football's equivalent of the Duckworth Lewis method be, Dom?
That makes sense, though.
I'm not getting into that conversation. I don't really understand it. So, and I know Kieran is the big cricket fan. He is keen for us to move on.
Stern now, anyway.
Oh, is it? Is it? Yeah. My mistake.
I didn't even understand those words you just said. That's how.
Someone from Armenia Bielefeld came up with it.
One final quick question on the Community Shield, Kieran. Penalties still beyond Haaland, not City's forte. The only question I've got is, why did Bernardo never take one during the great penalty troubles of 2019? It was a decent finish, though.
Oh, it was a great finish, yeah. Maybe it's his new kind of like scally alter ego that's got him with his head being shaved, that's got him fired up to take pens. The way Arsenal were celebrating, you know, as if they'd won something amazing, it just made me think Rodri has completely gone from hero to zero by scoring in the Champions League final and then missing a penalty in the Community Shield. If there's that level of importance placed in the competition all of a sudden.
Yeah. Rodri should never be allowed near a penalty again, should he? That's the thing.
I know. Yeah. So terrible. It was really, really similar to the one he scored against Spurs, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So it shouldn't be allowed. He nearly scored from the halfway line the game after scoring the one in the Champions League final.
Oh, man. I forgot about that.
You can't be such a hero, isn't he?
God, I hope he does something mad against Burnley. Let's talk about the Burnley game. We'll start the discussion about real football with a chat with a Burnley fan. I've been speaking to podcaster Kevin Robinson to find out more about their preparations for the coming season.
I don't think you could possibly have much of a better way to go up than we did. So going into the season with about as positive mindset as you can have. Obviously, the whole of last season was phenomenal. The end of last season was phenomenal. We've had a really positive summer, brought in some really good players on the pitch. It's been a positive summer off the pitch with lots of exciting people involved in the club. And I've been, watching Burnley for a while now. I've been around two promotion seasons, three promotion seasons even, a kind of Europa League season. But yeah, I genuinely can't remember a time where there's been so much intrigue, excitement, positivity. It's a really exciting time to be a Burnley fan.
Yeah, how does it compare to, when you think of the your Premier League seasons previously under Sean Dyche and then what culminated in the relegation season, there's something to be said, isn't there, about going down and battering the Championship for a year and coming back up?
Yeah, it's one of those things that fans only ever say after you've been relegated, but just as a neutral, I think the Championship for me is the best football league in the world. I think you've got that balance of genuinely like really high quality while being a lot more competitive than the Premier League is. Obviously, the Premier League is essentially two leagues. You've got the top kind of six or seven and then the rest of it. But yeah, you know, you look at the move, even before the relegation, we'd had like 10 years of Sean Dyche football, which was obviously successful, but had its own style. We've had, what, like 4 or 5 years of just standing still in the Premier League and knowing what we were getting every week and every season, both in terms of the style of football, but also just where we're going to end up, what results are going to be. And going down, having the season we had, but not just that, but I think it was a massive reset on so many levels. And the change the club has had in the last 12 months is absolutely unreal. And that feeds into everything. And yeah, whether that scale of change, both in terms of how the club is run, but also the footballing side of it, my excitement and the buzz around everything, whether that would have been the same if we kind of stayed up and not had this year in the Championship to, yeah, have that bit of a cultural reset, a style reset, a positivity reset. I don't know if it was. All I know is that the last 12 months have been absolutely incredible and I wouldn't have changed it for anything.
Yeah, and obviously you've got Vincent Kompany in charge, who, you know, there's not a City fan in the world who's got a bad word to say about him. He did seem to have you into pre-season a lot earlier than I expected, though. I mean, if reports are to be believed, you started pre-season 4 days before City played the Champions League final.
Yeah, it was. I think Kompany described it as a pre-season. Our league season finished about a month before your league season finished. Well, your competitive season finished, at least, sorry. So it's a long time to have the players not doing much. So they were in very early. Yeah, it was very strange to see pre-season starting while the current season had not officially finished. But it's real Kompany, right? He's just so focused and he doesn't really get distracted by anything. He's full on work ethic and putting hours and hours and hours into everything. And it really is indicative of Kompany's approach. And like I said, I'm sure you guys saw that when it was you. I'm sure I remember hearing, you know, he would stay behind at training and speak to Pep and watch kind of recordings of the previous matches while everyone had gone home. So I think what he's doing now is exactly what he was doing as a player as well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that relationship with Pep was huge while he was at City. We saw last season in the Championship that his style of football wasn't too dissimilar to Guardiola as well. How do you expect that will develop this season? Because it might be a different challenge coming up into the Premier League and trying to keep going with that.
Yeah, I think I can't remember who it was, but somebody shared like a really in-depth statistical look at how Burnley played, and it was, you looked at it side by side with City's, and it was very similar, but with our own style and his own stamp on it as well. And it's going to be really interesting, because I think actually teams who have come up and played good possession football have tended to do all right in the Premier League in the last few years. So I think that stands us in good stead. At the same time, obviously, we saw when we played you guys last season, there were challenges to that. I think we played United in the cup and got beat, but actually played really well against them. And for the first half, we were by far the better team and probably deserved to be ahead. And that was quite a tight defeat. Whereas when we played you guys, as we often tend to do, we got demolished. So we can compete in some games, but it's also very different from being the best team in the Championship to being one of the weakest in the Premier League. So, and the City game showed that. So it is going to have to adapt. You look at the players we brought in, and there doesn't seem to be any particular change in the style of play we brought in. It's still very much the same profile of players we're bringing in this summer to what we've had last season. So I don't think he's going to stray too much from what he did last season. We might just need that extra little bit of grit and steel at times, which inevitably is going to be needed in more challenging games. But I really do feel like from everything we've seen so far and also precedent set by other some teams, I think we're going to go out there and play pretty similar to what we did last season.
Yeah, and of course, you look at certainly the in terms of a style of play and where you're at after pre-season. You know, we saw in the Community Shield, City are still doing their thing where they approach a season quite slowly and, you know, it takes them a couple of weeks of the league campaign. If you're flying high with confidence and flying high with your preparations for the season, there is a good chance of this being a really good game, isn't there?
Yeah, whatever the result is, I think it will be a really good game. You've got two teams that want to play like really exciting football, two teams off the back of phenomenal seasons. You know, you look at a recipe book for what a great game is. You've got, it's the first game of the season, always exciting. You've got two teams coming off the back of kind of historic seasons, really exciting.
Night game as well, that always plays into it, yeah.
Exactly that, yeah. You've got the emotional connection between kind of the two managers and all of that. You've got the champions versus the team that has just come up from like, you put all these things into a recipe pot of what could make a really exciting fixture. And this is probably exactly what comes out of the other end of it. So, yeah, look, as a fan wanting to get points for the board, I look at the start of our season. It's probably not realistically the chances of that. This is probably statistically the lowest chance of getting that, but there's always a chance. We're going to be coming in full of confidence. You know, you never know what happens at the start of the season, but either way, you know, whatever happens on the pitch, it's an exciting start to a Premier League, and that's why we're here, right?
Yeah, you've mentioned a couple of times the transfer business you've done over the summer. There's one name in particular that I want to ask you about, and it's in goal, because James Trafford obviously came in from City. There was a big hoo-ha about the transfer fee, and then, he goes and proves himself with a crucial penalty save in an England final. So it's he's an exciting one, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. It's an interesting position, goalkeeper, because obviously we had Muric, again, from you guys last season, and I think like the first half of the season, he made a lot of Burnley fans very uncomfortable. He was very good with his feet, almost a midfielder really, but not particularly convincing in goal. I think you asked any Burnley fan at Christmas, does Muric play in the Premier League? And I don't think anyone would have said yes. He actually had a really strong second half of the season, and I think actually he'd won a lot of fans over by the end. And I don't think anyone really expected us to go in for a goalkeeper this summer. Having said that, look, I think he struggled under pressure at times last season, and company subbed him off twice after he'd made mistakes. And when that happened, probably even the first time that happened, that was probably the right number one from Juric. And bringing in Trafford, he seemed really excited. I think Trafford's stats alone are phenomenal in that, in terms of like the clean sheets he kept in a row last season, the goals conceded, you know, his performances for England over the summer. You know, he seems a lot much more rounded player. So yeah, it's really exciting to get over the line. Obviously, it's question mark, not question marks of it, but just intrigue. I said the word intrigue a few times, but you know, our record signing is someone who's never played above League One, which is bizarre. But everything you see about him is hugely exciting. I know that company went to see him play several times last season. I know that, like, at least four or five times he was over there watching him. So, you know, he was obviously convinced, and we've had a pretty good record at Burnley with goalkeepers, with Tom Heaton and Nick Pope. So let's add another one to the list.
Yeah. I also want to ask you about one player who won't be there next season, because Ashley Barnes has ended his, the club ended his 9-year stay with not renewing his contract. It's that feel like it's kind of like the right time, but it's one of those that is, you know, saying goodbye to a club legend.
Oh, don't you? Making my heart skip a beat talking about him. Look, I follow one footballer on Instagram, and it's Ashley Barnes. He's just an incredible figure at the club, and genuinely over summer, like I say once a week, I watched his, when we had the, you know, the kind of the trophy parade in Burnley a few days after we won the title, and he had his little speech in the town hall, and all the fans behind him singing, "You'll always be a claret." He's turning around saying, "Yes, I'll always be a claret." And like I genuinely watch that about once a week over the summer. Like, it's real, like, kind of goosebumps. It was difficult seeing him go at the end of last season, because he's, like I say, he's just been a massive part of what Burnley is, and he was probably our best player in the second half of last season. So it's strange to, in a way, to release the player who's been the best player for the last few months. But again, it's a bit of ruthlessness, I guess, from from Company again, that doing that role in the Championship at, you know, in your 30s is very different to the young side that Company's trying to build. And the players we've got to replace him in the forward line now are much younger, have got the careers ahead of them. And it's again, you know, it would have been very easy to give him another year and say, look, give us that experience in the Premier League. But got to trust when Company says, look, yeah, that's all great, but we want to build for the future and build a squad that is going to be around for the next kind of 5-10 years, then yeah, that's super exciting. So genuinely, like, incredibly sad to see him go, but Company's building a squad for the future. And realistically, does Barnes fit into that as a person? Probably yes. And I'd love to see him come back in a couple of years as involved in the club in some way. But does he fit into that on the pitch? When you look at the dynamic of a squad Company's building, probably not. I'm not going to say it's the right time for him to move on, because my heart can't allow me to say that. But what Company's doing is really exciting. And as much as things like that can be disappointing and hard to take at times, it's going to stand us in really good stead, I think.
Yeah, if he could, if Company though could just hold off that building for the first week of the season, I'd be quite happy. Kevin, let's have you.
We've not got a left back at the moment, so
join the club. Yeah. Right. Join the club. We've not done left backs in years. Kevin, let's have a prediction for the charity bet a bit later on. What score are you going for this one?
My head, the logistical thing is to say City are going to win this, but first game of the season, like I say, it's really positive around the club, so I'm going to come in and say we're going to go ahead, maybe not quite pick it up with a win, but we're going to draw, going to get 1-0 draw.
Lovely. Well, I tell you what, the one thing I always say at the start of the season before the fixtures are announced, the one thing I don't want is a newly promoted team away from home in the first couple of games, because they're the ones that are really tricky. And we couldn't have had a worse opening day for that in that regard. So, yeah, it'd be an interesting one.
Yeah, I mean, we couldn't have had much of a worse opening. Join the club.
Ad-free episodes are available on Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
That was Kevin Robinson talking to me about Burnley's preparations for the coming season. Dom, we kind of touched on it before. Are City going to be ready for this game? They like to be ready a few weeks into the season. And as I was chatting to Kevin, I was just kind of realising that Burnley have been ready for about 5 months.
Yeah, companies have them in training before they all found out games are going to be 15 minutes longer, so that might backfire. So before the Arsenal game, so before the Community Shield, Guardiola was saying that because City's season had obviously been gloriously elongated, they were 2 weeks behind Arsenal in their preparation. I mean, so you would think that's maybe a bit of a factor again, because they're a little bit further behind Burnley. And I think, obviously, they'll be right up for it. It's their first game back up. There's the Company factor. There'd probably be easier things to do on the first weekend. But, I mean, at the same time, I think City will be pretty confident of getting the job done.
Yeah, I mean, City took Burnley apart last season, Kieran. Can you read anything into that? Because at that time, Burnley were flying high as well. It's not like Burnley were kind of sneaking over the line to promotion. They were running away with the Championship by the point that City took them apart.
Yeah. It's a weird one, actually, because you're absolutely right. I remember being kind of nervous about that game with the Company factor and with those exact ideas about how high they were flying, and they were on their way back up again, you know, with months to spare, really. So they definitely looked like a club with Premier League pedigree at the time we were playing them, and then we absolutely demolished them. Haaland was just in full fighting form by then, and so were City, really. Wasn't that the week he scored like 8 goals in 2 games or something, was it? When
he scored 5 against Leipzig, yeah.
Yeah. I don't really want to bring this up on the podcast because it really, really opens myself up to, you know, looking foolish here, but
here we go.
I'm just ever so slightly concerned about Haaland and his drought.
Hat trick time. There we go.
Yeah, well, that's it exactly. Yeah, you could literally just play this next week when he gets 4 goals against Burnley. But Yeah, I don't know if it's confidence or maybe just like he was knackered come the end of things. But I think I said this on the show before. When he gave that penalty to Gundogan against Leeds.
Leeds.
Your pronunciation tonight is incredible.
No, it is. I know, but I'm slowing things up.
Is there a time dilation problem here? Are you operating on the other side of a wormhole or something?
But Dom did exactly what I wanted there and finished it off for me by confirming that it was actually right. So, yeah, so after he got bollocked by Guardiola for giving Gundogan the penalty, I don't know if he's been the same player. Like, he's only scored once since, and that was against Everton. And I'm slightly concerned. Nobody else is concerned because he's amazing and he's a machine, and there's no real reason to be worried when you know that he's got attributes that nobody in world football has. Like, but I just want him to find his form sort of sooner rather than later, really.
I wonder, you know, if it's a little bit of coincidence in that, as you say, towards the back end of last season, he's had a long season, things are starting to get a bit tired, the legs are getting a bit heavy, that sort of thing. And then you combine it with pre-season, the start of this season, he's just getting to fitness. So it's like of the curve, like he's in a trough at the moment, but that doesn't mean that the peak isn't very soon on the horizon.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely it. But to link it to your question about is there anything to read into the Burnley game last year when he was so fire and fit and in like incredible form that's never been seen before, really. You know, you had that, had a little bit more confidence about playing Burnley slightly because you felt that Haaland could just turn up and do madness. And at the moment, I just don't know if he's at full peak fitness, and you know, as you say, he is in his trough. But I'm fully hands up admitting that this could backfire tremendously for me, and he could, you know, he could surpass even last year's crazy records, and he could turn up on Friday night and demolish Burnley because he has it in him for sure. But just I would be ever so slightly less confident about this game than I was last year, even though I believe I said in this answer that I wasn't confident last year either. Don't have me in the show again.
the direction you took round the houses then is like, honestly, like if somebody was following you, they'd be going, "What? Where is this guy going?"
Do you know why that is? It's because I was so afraid to say in kind of like black and white, if you like, that I was worried about Haaland's form because it, you could just look so foolish from it. Like, it's a real famous last words thing to say.
Yeah.
To me, right, it feels like a grasp for the old comfort blanket of Cityitis that...
Maybe.
It's really hard to bang on about that stuff now when you've won a treble. So it's like, how do we get there? So yeah, you give it a shot.
Yeah.
You have to do monger a little bit, don't you? Even when everything's absolutely perfect. Like,
yeah. Team news time, Dom. Foden for a central role, maybe. He's been one that fans certainly want to see there. I'm just wondering, with the lack of options on the wing, whether he's actually going to get still stuck out on the wing.
Yeah, I think he's... I mean, stuck out on the wing, maybe, but also I think if Foden played on the right wing for a season, he could be the best right winger in the Premier League. Foden in mid... So there was the reaction to the Lucas Paquetá links that came out. A lot of negativity from City fans from that seems to stem around. But what about Foden in midfield? And yeah, everyone wants to see that. Maybe crucially, apart from Guardiola. And I think the fact that he came on in the Champions League final in that position and was fabulous.
If he'd scored the one-on-one in the Champions League final, or if he'd scored against Arsenal when he ran through the middle, would that change Guardiola's mind a bit?
No, I think if he scored the one in the Champions League final, everyone might have just run out of the stadium and gone straight to town. So that would have been something to absorb. It is a bit weird how his finishing does seem to have... He was a very instinctive finisher early on, wasn't he? And it wasn't as good last season, which I think I would trace back to when, you know, there was that, I think it might have been the first home game against Bournemouth where he should have squared it to Haaland and didn't and shot wide. And everyone was like, oh, when's he going to pass to Haaland? And then a couple of games later when he assisted one of the goals in Haaland's hat-trick against Palace, Haaland was like putting on Instagram, oh, finally, Phil, thanks for that. That only became a bit of a thing. So, and that was all fun and games, but I do think that presence of having Haaland there has maybe, and that isn't applicable to those two chances we're talking about, but I think that did bring up, I think he has started thinking in the penalty area a bit, which sometimes isn't a great thing. You know, his best goal of last season was that, it's either the first time finish, which is instinctive against United, or when he dribbles in from the right wing against Newcastle. And
yeah,
I think that's where you need him this year. I mean, I really like the idea of Phil Foden in centre midfield for City and for England. He's incredibly talented. But because of the Pouser element and wanting control, Guardiola isn't going to play him and De Bruyne as the two attacking midfielders in the same team. It's just not going to happen. And I think a lot of people thought he was going to play there because De Bruyne was likely to be out at the start of the season. He's recovered quickly, so that isn't an option. I honestly think the right-hand side, particularly if they're going to sign Paquetar, looks like where the opening is. You know, City will need to fill in that goals and assists void that Mahrez has left. And I think Foden's the guy capable of doing that. I mean, it's sacrilege. I'm going to annoy a lot of people with that because I know everyone wants to see him in midfield. But yeah, Guardiola said he sees his future in midfield, but and he says he can play five positions. But he's always said that about Foden, and he's still saying the thing about the defensive side of his game. So if that's the case, and you've got guys like Kovacic and Bernardo, maybe Paquetar, who can do that better, then I think why not go the right, you know, right wing is his shirt this year. Just go and rip it up.
Dom, you sound like you know more about Paquetá than I do and maybe some of the other listeners. Like, what is it that we would be looking for if that signing went through?
He's a really nice... I wonder if, you know, say we were saying earlier that Guardiola doesn't really sign midfielders and just chuck them in. I wonder if the fact that Kovacic has worked so well, that's made him think, oh, let's go for this again. Because he's not a similar type of player to Kovacic, but he does also tick a lot of those Guardiola boxes, have been technically very good, keeps the ball well, nice little short passes. He's a good dribbler. He would probably be, because if you think back to the end of last season, a lot of people saying Kovacic is Gundogan's replacement. They were going to do Kovacic anyway, and then Gundogan left.
Yeah.
Basically, Paquetá would be more of the Gundogan replacement. He would be getting a little bit more further forward. You know, he starts for Brazil, and like say in the World Cup with Brazil, he was playing both like as a very attacking midfielder, like alongside Neymar. And then if Neymar went and was playing further up front, he would tuck in and sort of play next to Casemiro holding. And like that's the sort of thing that, you know, that sounds very Gundogan, doesn't it? Can sort of do both of those things. I think the short-handed version of it would be he would be the actual Gundogan replacement, whereas if he doesn't come in, the Gundogan replacement is a bit of Kovacic, a bit of Bernardo, a bit of Foden.
Yeah. Kieran, for the defensive side of things going to Burnley, knowing that Burnley are not the sort of rough and tumble team that they used to be and that they're going to get it down and play it a little bit more under Vincent Kompany, I'm wondering who you want in the back four, because obviously City are going with that centre-halves at full-back thing again this season. I'm just wondering, would you dare chuck in? I mean, we're talking about Croatians. You know, all of a sudden Guardiola's got another one in the squad now with Guardiola, who, by the way, the most boring man on the planet. Would you chuck him in?
Yeah, I think so. If you're going to make your Premier League debut, do it on a Friday night under the lights at Turf Moor. what could be more glamorous than that? I mean,
better than watching a movie, isn't it?
Yeah, or eating chicken. The only thing is, I'm trying to work out the whole of the back four because we are so overly abundant in defenders. It makes absolutely no sense. And if you think to yourself, you know, maybe I'll leave out him in place of Guardiola, then you realise that. So I would obviously like John Stones to play because I love him and he's brilliant. So maybe Guardiola on the left, Stones and Diaz in the middle, and Walker on the right. Would that make sense? But then you think to yourself, he loves a kanji. Is Ake fit? I don't know. But you know, you don't want these good, solid defenders to be left out. And I still love Laporte, but it looks as if there's no way back for him now in the back four. But yeah, it would be nice to see Stones and Diaz playing if Guardiola's going to make his debut, because you know they for me are the best two, and they're the absolute rock. And has Guardiola been signed as a sort of left back? Inverted kind of style, is he going to wander into midfield at some point? So it would be dead interesting, and you know, maybe Kompany, who thinks he's got, you know, he sort of knows Pep and knows the way things will pan out, or is making a few predictions about what he might see. Guardiola starting might be the sort of like the curveball, the spanner in the works as such, so it might be a nice place to throw him in.
Yeah, when I interviewed Joe Royal years ago, and he talked about taking the job on at City and arriving at City, they had 52 professional players at the time. He kept saying about how he was going to Platt Lane and then he'd turn a corner and there'd be three other people that he'd completely forgotten were part of his squad. I just wonder if Guardiola's like that with centre-halves these days. Like, yeah. he sat in the training room, then he turns around and there's another one that he's like, oh God, I've forgotten about you. Let's talk about the Super Cup, because apparently that's a thing that's happening that I'd completely forgotten about. And because I'm, again, not really sure how to play this one, let me introduce Lambros Cyrumos from the Gate 7 International podcast.
Hi there, Manchester City fans. My name is Lambros Cyrumos from the Gate 7 International podcast.
See, I told you that's who he was. He does a podcast about Olympiacos. This game is being played in Olympiacos' stadium. So I thought the most interesting thing to do was talk about some things to do with the Olympiacos stadium. So I'm just going to pepper these in from Lambros throughout the chat that we have. So let's kick us off.
The Kadiskaki Stadium was originally built in 1895, a year after City were formed, and demolished and rebuilt again in 2004, facing in the opposite direction, near the water in the port.
There you go, stadium 1 year younger than City, there you go.
In 2008, mate, wrong.
Yes, I was thinking the same.
In all seriousness, Dom, how much does this game actually matter to Guardiola? Because there is the Guardiola thing of, you know, got to win every trophy.
Yeah, I think it does. To generalise, in Europe, like the Super Cups are more of a big deal than over here. And I think Guardiola does really like the Charity Shield, but he's been dragged down by our general British attitude to it, of going, mate, it doesn't really matter. I mean, I guess it matters to him. And I suppose from a fan point of view, it's kind of cool, isn't it? Because it's a game City have never been involved in before. It's a game Sevilla are always involved in because, you know, death taxes and Sevilla win the Europa League. So, yeah, I think it will matter to him. And it is more important than the Charity Shield, but wouldn't we say that now?
Now that we've lost. Before we carry on.
Olympiacos play all their home games at the Kadiskaki Stadium. There's actually a deal that sees the club lease it and allow Ethnikos Piraeus to play there as well, but they don't. Ethnikos Piraeus is now in the lower divisions in Greece and hasn't played in Kadiskaki Stadium ever, I believe.
A ground share without a second tenant. That's interesting.
Hold on a second, David. Why is this man talking about the stadium so much?
Because I basically went onto the Wikipedia page and found a load of interesting things out as I was reading it. So I mean, like, listen.
The stadium is known for hosting cinemas in the summer. In 2005, it screened the movie Batman Begins.
They had that. It was a cinema for one summer. That's just
got that man on for his gorgeous voice.
I mean, Lambros is very smooth. He's been on before. He's very smooth.
In Gate 7, there's 21 seats that are blacked out as a tribute to those who lost their lives in the Kadiskaki Stadium disaster, Olympiacos and Ike fans.
Yeah, it's a fascinating stadium. Yeah. Sorry about bringing the mood down there. Sevilla were a bit tricky, Kieran, in the Champions League groups last season. What do you reckon to this game?
Wasn't it like 4-0 and 3-1?
It was 4-0 the first leg, which that's why I say a little bit tricky, because the second leg was, I mean, it really, really wasn't a good game. And Rafa Mir scored like, and was causing City problems until City just kind of moved into third gear.
Yes, I remember that now. Was that the game Rico Lewis scored in?
I think so, yeah. But yeah, I couldn't remember if that was Borussia Dortmund or not.
They've always been tricky enough on paper, I think. And then City, as you sort of allude to, managed to just pick it up a gear and go for it, and usually get the win. I quite like them. There's a lot of City links between them. I'm excited for this game because we're playing at this stadium, which famously shows cinema pictures in the summer.
Well, you say that. I mean, I've got another one.
We've also seen many different artists come to the Kadiskaki Stadium, including Rihanna, Aerosmith, 50 Cent, Whitesnake, Def Leppard, and the Sex Pistols. They've all performed at the Kadiskaki Stadium in Piraeus.
There you go. Didn't know that, did you?
That is cool. That is very, very cool. And now they're hosting the Super Cup. So the stage is set.
Yeah, there's
Whitesnake and Def Leppard on the same bill, surely.
yeah.
There's one good omen that Lambros has for us, though, Dom.
The last European final held at the stadium was won by an English team, and it was the 1971 Cup Winners' Cup final where Chelsea beat Real Madrid.
That's the only time that they've hosted a European final, and the English side beat the Spanish side.
Of course, Chelsea knocked City out of that season's European Cup Winners' Cup. So.
Yes, they did.
Cheers, Lambros.
Yeah. Well, instead of derailing the show further, let's get some predictions for the charity bet. The Community Shield result might not have mattered that much to us as fans, but it did for the charity bet. We had a winner to kick us off for this season. Chris Higginbottom correctly predicted the 1-1 draw in 90 minutes, winning £65 for the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group. William Hill is giving us 3 £10 correct score singles, and the winnings are going to help fight food poverty in Manchester. We heard from Kevin earlier on that he's gone for a 1-1 draw between City and Burnley at Turf Moor. That's 9-1 and £90 if he's right. Kieran, what are you having for this?
I've gone for 2-0 to City.
2-0 City is 11-2 and £55 if you're right. Dom?
I've got 3-1 City.
3-1 City is 11-1 and £110 if you're right. Dom, what are you having for the Sevilla game?
I've got Kieran's score from Burnley. I've got 2-0 City against Sevilla.
That's 5-1 and £50. I've given Sevilla a goal in that to make it 2-1 City. That's 7-1 and £70. Kieran?
I've got Dom's score from Sevilla. I've gone for 3-1. I've just basically copied Dom's homework and changed it up a little bit so we didn't get caught.
Yeah. 3-1 is 9-1 and £90 if you're right. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change and please gamble responsibly. To find out more about responsible gambling, then take a look at begambleaware.com. org. Now then, City and Burnley open this year's Premier League season on a Friday night. It's not the first Premier League game City have played on a Friday, but Friday games are not a frequent thing by any means. Sam Roscoe has been taking a look at City's Friday matches during the Premier League era.
There's been at least one Friday game in each of the last four seasons. Most recently, it was an FA Cup win over Arsenal last January.
That game, difficult, I didn't expect. They approached with discourage, the man-to-man. When this happened, make the process difficult.
The year before, it was a cup tie against Swindon, where Cole Palmer impressed both on and off the pitch.
They enjoyed it on there. Roddo told me, go wide, stay wide, create things, and that's what I tried to do, and luckily it paid off.
And what do you make of your first FA Cup goal? Not one in the Premier League yet, but your first FA Cup goal for City.
I know, yeah, delighted. Prem soon come, but just got to take it game by game, day by day, and hopefully work my way up.
The FA Cup is a source of Friday games. In Guardiola's first year, there was a 5-0 win over West Ham in the third round on a Friday night. That was one of the first times his team put in the level of performance we now expect from them.
The last month and a half, we were not able to make passes in a row. It was our game, it was unpredictable in the sense that the ball is always up and down. Today we control a bit more through the passes.
And going further back, City's only ever first and second round FA Cup ties were on Fridays too. In 1998, they beat Halifax 3-0 at Main Road in round one, and then drew with Darlington at Feetham's in round two, before later winning the replay. David Preece was in goal for Darlington.
Both games were closely contested. I remember Paul Dickoff scoring a late equaliser at Feetham's to take it to that second game. And considering the state of our pitch at Feetham's at the time, which was it had been better served as for growing potatoes, really.
Weirdly, there's also been a Champions League game on a Friday night, thanks to the COVID-19 pandemic, when football restarted in 2020. City's second leg with Real Madrid in the last 16 was rescheduled for a Friday. Gabriel Jesus spoke to BT Sport after scoring the winner.
It's a Real Madrid, it's a top club. They can beat us, so that's why we come to the pitch to work hard again and try to win and play our football. We have to keep working, do simple things, and stay strong to next game.
Every other one of City's Friday games since 1992 has been in the league. The most recent was after they'd won the title in 2021. They played at Newcastle, a game remembered for Scott Carson completing 90 minutes in goal. Guardiola spoke afterwards.
The people maybe doesn't know, but he's a real leader for us. He says straight away, the young guys and the old guys, what he believes. He has a lot of experience, has been in incredible locker rooms and big teams. And we are the light, not just me, Eddie, the second one, and Zach, and especially as well the players, today he could play. So yeah, it was 3 goals at pieces, could not do anything, but so happy for him to make a debut.
City won that match 4-3. In fact, Guardiola has only ever lost once on a Friday at City. That was at Wolves over Christmas in 2019. And City fan Richard Burns gave his verdict on the podcast.
We played nearly a full match there with 10 men. I actually thought City equipped themselves pretty well for the majority of it. But, of course, they had a 2-0 lead and they've managed to lose the game 3-2. And there's more than one instance within those goals where you can look and say, if it's not for a direct City error or a mistake from a City player, then City still don't concede those goals and they win that game.
There have been a few festive Friday games for City, like a 3-1 win at West Brom in the snow on Boxing Day in 2014. Bakary Sanya spoke to City TV afterwards.
We started the game really well. We managed to make the difference quite early and it gave confidence to the team. And I think it's one of the best starts we had from the season.
I think a lot of people always hope for a white Christmas, but just how difficult were those conditions out there?
It was quite difficult, nearly impossible to play because the ball was very slow and it was quite difficult to see as well.
Two other Boxing Day games have fallen on Fridays. One was City's 5-1 win over Hull in 2008, remembered for Phil Brown's half-time team talk on the pitch. The other was a 2-1 loss at Birmingham in 2003. Birmingham fan and podcaster Mark Watson picked that game as his heaven choice in one of this season's Patreon shows.
As a general rule, I don't go to games over Christmas because that's for like family and getting fat and various things like that. But then when Fowler scores early on, I'm thinking, I'm missing my turkey. I'm missing the Great Escape on TV. I wish I wasn't here. For us to pull that back, it was just a hell of a result and a hell of a day, really.
For some reason, games aren't played on Good Friday in the Premier League anymore. That was a source of 4 of City's Friday matches, including a 2-0 win at Tottenham in 2003. Joey Barton scored in that game.
I played the second game against Spurs at White Hart Lane and scored, beat them down there. I actually thought it was quite an easy ground to go to. I thought, oh, you must win here all the time. I didn't realise how difficult it was to get results at White Hart Lane.
Many of City's Friday games actually came in the Football League. After relegation in 1996, they opened the Division 1 season with a 1-0 win over Ipswich on a Friday night at Main Road. After that, they only won one of their next 11 Friday league games. That was at Stoke in 1999.
It is still fresh in mind because I've got two pictures at home. They're in my my carriage is now like a pop. And one, I'm controlling the ball, and the second picture is of scoring the goal. So I'll see it every day, so I'll remember it. But it was a corner, and I've got the ball. I control it on my head, and while the ball was still in the air, I had to kick it very quick. So I had to jump. I can't remember how I did it, but it's just. Impulse, you see it and you think, oh, I have to do it quick. And it went in very, very nice.
The next victory was a big one. 1-0 over Birmingham in the year 2000. It put City to within a point of promotion and there was a post-match pitch invasion. Dom Farrell ran on the pitch at full time.
When I ran on, I playfully smacked Moonchester on the back of the head because you're running past a 7 foot novelty big blue alien. I thought it'd be a big foam head. It's actually very hollow. Maybe nowadays with City's increased resources, we've got a better Moonchester costume. But at the time, it was quite sort of hollow Frank Sidebottom kind of vibe to it. But yeah, I hit it because I thought it was like hitting a big, like, funny cushion. But then you think about it, as if you're going to put a bloke's head in like a massive sort of 1 metre wide cushion. Of course it was hollow.
Since the night Dom assaulted Moonchester, City have lost only twice in their 12 matches on a Friday and only once since Sheikh Mansour's takeover. Let's hope they can keep that record going for the season opener against Burnley this Friday night.
Hi, this is Sean Gutter, and you're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
That was Sam Roscoe looking at the Friday games. A surprising number of talking points come with City on a Friday. Dom, I mean, I have to give you the opportunity to defend yourself, unlike you gave Moonchester on that Birmingham game. We heard how you just decided to give the mascot a little bit of a beating there. That was an exciting Friday game, though, wasn't it?
Can I just say it's great because that was on the Patreon, away from prying ears, and
I've made it public. Yeah.
You have to reapply for your pass to get into Premier League games as media every year. I've not had mine through yet, so I mean that's probably knackered, isn't it? Invasion of the playing area and assaulting a giant alien. In my defense, I was a very excitable 13-year-old, and I defy anyone to run past Moonchester's big head in a bit of excitement and not go, yeah, come on. But yeah, it was a horrible nerve shredding night. It was that Birmingham game and the Wigan playoff one the year before, all kind, in my mind's eye, sort of all mush into one sort of both horrible and euphoric experience, because they were scrappy 1-0 wins and everyone ran on the pitch at the end before we'd even been promoted anyway. So yeah, it was good crap.
Yeah. Kieran, there's some cracking Fridays that were and weren't mentioned in that feature as well. The Phil Brown halftime team talk at Eastlands in 2008, that happened on a Friday. It was Boxing Day, but that was a Friday game.
See, I think this is a bit ropey the way you've done this. If Boxing Day falls on a Friday, is it a Friday game? Like?
Well, a good Friday. There's some good Friday games in there.
Yeah. That's what I mean. Like some of the festive style games that when you don't know what day of the week it is, don't actually, in my head, seem to count as Friday games. So it was a real
okay.
So it was a real surprise to see the list and to hear the feature and to know. It took me by surprise.
Okay, so strike that one out then. Strike out the snow at West Brom all the pretty pitches.
I'm praising you for your resilience in approaching this, because other podcasts may not have found a feature in this, but you scratched beneath the surface.
Yeah, we go where others dare not to tread.
Yeah. Yes, the Phil Brown berating his team, amazing. I don't know. Well, did it do some good? I guess it did, because City didn't score in the second half, did they?
I think they both scored. I think they drew the second half 1-1.
Right. But yeah. So it sort of shored things up a little bit. Obviously the follow up for that was the Bullard piss take kind of mocking celebration of it the following time when they visited the Etihad, and Phil Brown's kind of sardonic little laugh off it. It was quite funny, I guess. I've talked about this. The Wolves one, where Ederson got sent off because I was dressed as a monk in the pub.
Oh yeah,
I talked about that on the Patreon before. Yeah, So there were, yeah, there are a lot of funny little memories that come along with Friday night games, it turns out.
Yeah, there's Wolves on a Friday night spells, you know, doom, doesn't it, Dom? Because they got battered 4-1 there in 99 on a Friday night.
Yeah, Robert Taylor's debut, that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was a recurrent Friday night character, that Birmingham one. To pick up on the religious theme from Kieran dressed as a monk.
were you dressed as a bishop for that one?
No. So one of the Good Friday wins, I believe, was when City beat Liverpool in 1995.
Yeah.
Which that was before Premier League games on Good Friday was a thing, but it got moved because it was the weekend of the Hillsborough anniversary. And this, so at the time I was a church attending altar boy, and this caused a bit of a ruckus with my mum that me and my dad were going to go and watch City instead. And I remember saying to the priest that I couldn't serve mass because I was going to go and watch City get crucified instead. I thought for an 8-year-old was a really good bit of wordplay.
That's amazing. You're going to
it
hell.
It wasn't particularly well received, but they didn't get crucified because Maurizio Gaudino scored a brilliant header that, like, I've looked for on YouTube and can't find. I think it was a diving header from, like, about the penalty spot, but in my mind's eye, it was from about 25 yards out. He's, like, the best header I've ever seen. That was a fondly remembered one. And the family are all still friends, so it's all good.
Good. Scott Carson played 90 minutes at Newcastle, Kieran, 2021, out of nowhere. That was a Friday night. Who knew?
I didn't know that. Was that the one where Ferran Torres scored?
Yeah, he scored a hat-trick with some brilliant goals in there as well.
Yeah. We'd won the league. Was it wrapped up? Yes, obviously, because that's why Carson was playing, yeah. Why would that have been a Friday night? Was it just because it was the mad COVID season and all bets were off kind of thing?
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, just rescheduling games left, right and centre at that point in the season. Before we move on, I do want to give a shout out to, we heard him in the feature there, the head and volley at Stoke by Gerard Vikins. I want to tell the story about Gerard Vikins because obviously that interview came from when I interviewed him for the Wembley book about 10 years ago now. And he is the nicest man on the planet because I went to the Netherlands to speak to him. I'd emailed him and I interviewed him for the podcast before. I'd only done it over the phone. I knew I wanted to make a documentary, so I wanted it in quality audio. And so I emailed him and just said, "Listen, I'll come and meet you in the Netherlands if you can give me an hour." And he didn't. He gave me a whole day of his life. And so he came to the hotel in the morning. We did the interview, and then at that point he said, "Do you want to come and see where I work?" So he took me to Groningen, where he then worked at the time. Showed me around the stadium and kind of like described what his role was. Then took us to Veendam, which is the club that's now out of business, but the only club he played for that wasn't City. He moved from Veendam to City, back to Veendam. And we kind of talked about how the club had closed down, ran out of money, that sort of thing. Then we got back in the car, and as we're, you know, you get that sense of direction sometimes when you're driving somewhere, someone else is driving, and you're going, this isn't the right way. Because he said he was taking us back to the hotel and I was like, I'm sure this is not the right way. Anyway, we turned into this residential estate and he said, "Oh, by the way, this is where I live. Come in. And we went in. His garage, he's converted into an English style pub. He's got he's got shirts all over it. So framed shirts of players that he's played against. He's got Ruud van Nistelrooy's shirt from the final derby at Main Road, where he basically pocketed van Nistelrooy for 90 minutes. And up there on the wall is two photographs of him scoring this goal at Stoke, where he controls it on his head and then volleys it into the top corner. And it's honestly, genuinely, one of the nicest men in football, one of the best experiences of my life doing any sort of podcast and writing stuff. And I've not got a bad word to say about him. So I wanted to tell the story of how Gerard Vikins basically abducted me from the hotel and took me to his house, and then took me to his garage where he's got a pub set up. It was really nice.
Pretty surreal.
Yeah. It was a lovely, lovely afternoon in the Netherlands.
Class.
Let's finish with some quick fire predictions. We always do these, and I definitely didn't forget last week to do them, and I definitely planned it for this week. So let's do them now. You know the drill. One sentence max as your answer. Kieran, we'll start with you. Who will win the title this season and why?
Chelsea, because I never like to say City, and I hate all the rest of the teams.
You know, you said that last season and the season before and the season before that. So
yes,
congratulations for being consistent.
And who won the league in all those seasons, David?
Yeah, okay, superstitious bugger. Dom, who won the title this season and why?
Man City, because to set Kieran's mind at ease, Erling Haaland's not shit.
Okay, Richard did exactly that last season to find out where the balance lay in the superstition stakes, so we'll find out again this year. Dom, Haaland aside, who will be City's top scorer this season?
Phil Foden.
Kieran?
Oh, I was going to say that.
You still can.
Alvarez.
Okay, Kieran, how many trophies will City win this season?
Two. Wait, actually, this is the Super Cup, isn't there? Three.
Is it a trophy, though? That's the question. Dom?
Well, it is now.
Are we counting the European Super Cup?
I will let you count whatever you want to.
All right, so both Super Cups, that and the Club World Cup, and...
Wait, there's another one?
Yeah, there's the Club World Cup. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Super Cup, Club World Cup, I think they'll win. And then one of the big ones, but not both. Okay. Either Champions League or Premier League. I think the squad's not quite there. Cup runs might be a bit tricky and need a lot of luck. So, yeah, three.
Three. Dom, which City player will be the surprise of the season and why?
That's hard when you sort of know about them all. Rico Lewis, because I think he might play midfield a bit more, or he's just... The kid's class, and he can be whatever he wants to be, and it's going to be exciting.
Yeah. Kieran?
I think the surprise of the season will be Kovacic. I think he'll just fit in really well and be even better than we thought.
Yeah. Kieran, which player needs a good season and why?
I've already mentioned him, but Alvarez, I think. Towards the tail end of last season, I thought he looked a bit tired. And although he was popping up with a goal here and there, I don't think he was taking games by the scruff of the neck enough, and he was going missing a little bit. So I would like to see him perhaps do a little bit more.
Yeah. Dom, good season. Why?
I'd say Foden again, even though I think he will. For the first time in his career last season, he kind of plateaued a bit. It's always been up and up. So seeing how he responds to that... the areas of need in the team with Gundogan and Mahrez going and the goals they provide, I think City need a big Phil Foden season.
And finally, Dom, we'll start with you. Who will win the most money on the charity bet this season?
Didn't you have a good run, actually, David, last season? Let's say, well, you're going to win the most money on charity bet.
Finally, somebody has said that. And like, I always make a big song and dance about nobody saying me, bearing in mind that I generally do the most over the course of a season. And
yeah,
I've won
see,
the
people,
most money.
People think you just give your predictions away to your guests, but there's not a guest for every club. And I'm on to how you game in the system, don't we?
Yeah, and last season and the season before, I won the most money each time and nobody said me. Kieran?
Well, I'm not saying you now. Higgy, because he's already off to a great start, and he's a wonderful friend.
Excellent. Well, we'll see how on the money you two are with those later in the season. But for now, that's it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. Please go and give it a rating and a review where you can. And if you can, please sign up to our Patreon. The bonus shows are now back, and we've got a clip of this week's coming up very soon. All the details are on patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. Thank you very much to my guests for today's show. Dom Farrell.
Thanks, mate.
And Kieran Murray.
Cheers, Blues.
See you next time.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
My granddad, right, he's a big, he was the biggest City fan ever. And me and him used to chat every game. After the game, I'd ring him up and chat, and he loved City. And when he died, his funeral song he chose was The Impossible Dream. And I always remember a flag at Old Trafford that said The Impossible Dream, and it had a treble on it. And every time I put that song on, or it came on in a movie, it made me cry, right? Yeah. And I could never listen to the Impossible Dream song without it making me cry. And I thought, if we win the Champions League, I'm going to get a flag made, the Impossible Dream, in tribute to my granddad. And I got back to my hotel room at 6 a.m. in Turkey, and I lay on the bed, and I thought, I'm going to put the Impossible Dream on, because I knew it'd make me cry. But it didn't make me cry. It made me smile. And I can't describe it, right? I just think it's full circle. I think there's a lot of City fans of my era and older that are finally at rest with it. And I think you can't ever take this football club anywhere where we haven't been before.
Yeah.
So you can take us to the depth of Division 2 if you want. There'll still be 30,000 there. And you can take us back to the Champions League final. We've been there, we've done it. We've got the T-shirt.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. And join us again next time for another episode.